Welcome back for another helping of oysters, clams, and cockles presented by Bolin Media. I am Ross Bolin here with Barrett Dudley to discuss part two of True Detective, Night Country. And while watching this show might make you feel cold, things are certainly heating up by the end of episode two, Barrett. Wouldn't you say?
I think mostly what I would say is...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like that's, a frozen ice zombie?
Yeah, because sometimes you're just frozen with fear. And then somebody breaks off your entire arm.
Yeah, it happens.
And you have to turn your frozen head and do a zombie scream that never gets mentioned for the entirety of the episode. So, like, you know, that sometimes that's just the way it goes.
That is the way life is sometimes, you know.
That's the way the cookie crumbles.
One of those tough lessons you learn.
Right. It's the way the ice thaws.
Let's dive into this thing, because there was a lot to unpack, a lot to digest. We start the episode on the ice with this frozen block of dead scientists from Salal Station. They're all naked. We got ruptured eardrums on some of them. And Danvers and her squad are using paintbrushes to try and clear the ice.
Brush away the ice a little bit.
Yeah, and the snow. And they're clearly not experts in this field of frozen dead body handling. One of the scientists, of course, has the spiral tattoo drawn onto his forehead.
Yeah.
Apparently not a tattoo. It's like Sharpie or something. And one guy has scratched his own eyes out. One guy is biting himself. There's a lot happening in this pile of frozen dead men, you know, of course, minus the one who is alive.
Yeah, it's a bit of a Renaissance painting.
It is, yeah. You know? Very much so.
Yeah.
Danvers says it's going to be a shit bowl, no answers, bunch of angry people, we don't have a forensic technician, we should send this thing back to Anchorage, yeah, we're keeping it, fuck Anchorage. This was a weird little exchange here, where before she's even finished talking, she's decided against letting the higher authorities with the forensic experts handle the case. She's decided to take it on herself, and the squad that she's got out there with her, they're really acting a fool. You've got one guy taking a selfie with the bodies, and Navarro is oddly watching from a distance when Rose walks up and suggests that they go home, and Navarro says that this is tied to Annie's case, and Rose says, oh, then you're screwed.
Yeah.
Come and see me later. And so this is another example on this show. There was several in episode one, or part one, rather, where we see that there's a lot of history between all these characters. Like, Navarro and Rose, just from this scene alone, seems like they've spent quite a bit of time together, which, of course, later we find out they're friends of some kind.
Yeah.
But, just to get through this opening chaos, Navarro steps on some clothes and shoes that are neatly folded by her feet, which clearly belong to the frozen men who are, like, roughly 50 yards away from her. And then Officer Wilson snaps one of the dead guy's arms off. And it turns out that dead guy is actually alive, and he starts screaming like Barrett did at the top of the show because Wilson just snapped his arm off. Okay, just how was this guy alive?
Well,
we think they've been out there multiple days.
So, okay.
It's like a cryogenic freezing thing, like Austin Powers?
What I decided after, you know, the rest of the episode unfolds is that didn't happen.
So you think he didn't actually scream and come alive?
No. I don't know what that was. I don't, like, but it. I think that we are being shown things on this show that aren't there.
But I'll say this.
The only other reference point that I have so far is the polar bear out in the middle of the road, right? But,
sure.
Like, I think people are seeing things and hearing things, and this is mentioned by, like the vending machine guy, right?
Yeah.
That, like, in Ennis, you see shit.
Yeah.
Right, because they would have referenced and mentioned the fact that the guy was like screamed like a zombie.
I mean, you would think so. Here's the problem. First of all, I think the polar bear is Navarro's spirit animal, so I don't think that was actually there. I do believe she saw it, like that was a vision of sorts. But after this intro sequence, like after the Billie Eilish music plays, the first thing we see is Danvers on the phone. and she is trying to get to speak to the guy that Wilson just mutilated by breaking his arm off and that woke up screaming. And they tell her, definitely not today, because he's in an induced coma. So she's trying to go interview that guy, which makes me believe that what we saw with him screaming actually did occur.
I already need to rewatch this episode.
In fairness, I've rewatched it twice.
That is what I thought as well. I was like, okay, what is happening here? I don't think so. I think that was a totally different thing she was talking about. I feel like she's talking about her dad or something.
It's entirely possible. It's not confirmed in that conversation, but that my brain went straight to okay, so he is alive and they're trying to interview him immediately. And the nurse on the phone is no, she says we're going into surgery now. And she also says we're going to have to amputate at least one leg. So it makes me think that, but here's the part where your reasoning, I think, is probably common here, because this was really confusing. The fact that nobody is blown away by how this dude was alive on the ice, if indeed he was, and the fact that he's gets his arm broken off and lets out this horrific zombie scream was bizarre. And then the episode just moves on from it. It was far and away the strangest thing in the whole episode, right? To the point that Barrett, and I'm sure other people, are questioning whether or not what we saw with that scream was even real. Well, if it even happened.
It's just not even possible. It's not
that's why I went to the cryogenic freezing thing.
That
I was
dude
like,
is
okay,
definitely frozen to death. Maybe you do not survive. He's not a frozen caveman in a, you know, they don't
That's where my brain went with it, though. It's maybe it just froze him so quickly and it preserved him in the ice. And then I have no idea, man. I have no idea. When we watched the scene for the first time, my wife thought all of them were alive. Because the way the shot is framed, you kind of think they've all suddenly woken up and are doing a zombie thing. But again, having rewatched it a couple of times, it's just the one dude. It's the guy that gets his arm snapped off. And Danvers reacts that she's seen something real there. It doesn't give you a bunch of context because it immediately cuts to the Billie Eilish intro sequence.
Yeah, right.
Anyway,
right.
Very, very confusing stuff there. And I would, if he is alive, I would like to know how. Please and thank you to the science community.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm trying to do a little bit of quick research here to figure out if that guy was actually
had survived somehow.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. I guess he is alive.
Yeah.
That's right.
So.
Scientist Anders Lund. Is a non-corpse stuck in a corpsicle. He awakens when a clumsy officer breaks his arm off, unleashing a scream that rivals the most chilling of zombie groans. Imagine coming back to consciousness, numb from frostbite, blinded by your time out on the tundra, and trapped in ice, enmeshed with the dead bodies of your coworkers. Yeah, okay, so is that guy is gone in the corpsicle? He's not in the corpsicle anymore?
Yeah, they extract him from the corpsicle. And he is taken to a hospital where apparently they are performing surgery on him to amputate one of his legs.
Okay. What the fuck?
Yeah, we're going to need some explanation there about how, because in the first episode, they give us all this context. They're like, look at the mayonnaise. Look at the laundry. They've been gone for 48 hours. So these guys have been out there for a couple of days. And what you have to guess is sub-zero temperatures. They spend all this time talking about why would you run outside without shoes on?
We know it's well below freezing.
Yeah.
Because one, of the way everybody's dressed, two, they're in the Arctic Circle, everything's ice and it won't stop snowing. And then the confirmation is that they need somewhere to thaw this thing out.
Yeah. They're a corpse.
That's gonna be over 32 degrees. So obviously it is not it's well below freezing the entire time that you are outside. I do not know how this is possible. I'm going to need an explanation.
Yeah, they will have to come back and address that somehow. It's crazy that they don't in this episode. Like, she makes that phone call, and you get that intro sequence, and then they never come back to, discuss how Lund came out of this and, the lawsuit that's going to ensue because they snapped his arm off. Fucking insane.
Well, I mean, that means his entire body is frozen. He is basically an icicle.
Yeah. But somehow his heart is thumping in his chest and he has the ability to go,
We could sit here for the entire hour I know, to discuss it's, this.
So and
we
it's
can,
a problem.
We'll move on.
It's
we'll
a problem. On. But yeah. anyway, speaking of science, Danvers visits a science teacher named Bryce at some school to ask about what Salal Station does. And it turns out Danvers had a sexual relationship with this guy. And almost every guy on the show.
Yeah, Danvers.
She gets around.
It's revealed to us in this episode. In this episode, has a bit of an appetite.
She does.
A sexual one.
She does. And Bryce, this teacher, tells Danvers that the Salal Station guys spent decades trying to sequence the DNA of an extinct microorganism that could potentially stop cellular decay. So he goes on to explain that it could be used to do things like solve cancer, genetic issues. But it sounds like it could also be like an anti-aging thing. Who knows? Mm-hmm. He also says that they were reclusive madmen at the Salal Station and that like normally at these Arctic stations, groups get cycled in and out so that you don't go crazy.
Right.
And so that you can rejoin society. These guys never did that. They all just stayed out there, had no contact with the city. Like they never came into town. And Bryce also says that the work they were doing, this sequence that DNA, microorganism, trying to stop cellular decay, that it was never going to work. He says that, like, the permafrost makes it impossible, basically, for what they were doing to make sense.
Which, to get it out carefully enough.
And right.
Then, yeah, there's, like, yeah, a bunch of reasons why he says it he didn't think it would ever actually work.
Which just begs the question, like, okay, what the hell, what are they, like, if this, like, high school science teacher can tell you what they were doing was never going to work, then what's the deal with the ICE station, this research station? And,
yeah,
you know, we find out a little about the funding later.
Yeah.
And it all becomes kind of a bit, it's just, there's some kind of a conspiracy going on there, it would seem.
Yeah, and I would also just add, I mean, beyond the conspiracy, I feel like, you know, it's kind of like having an, I don't know, let's just say that the best metaphor I can come up with off the dome is like, there's just suddenly a safe in your house, and you know it has $100 billion in it. And it's not crackable.
Yeah.
You're going to try to, you're still
you
going to try. You're going to try to get in it. It's got $100 billion in it and you're sitting right next to it.
Sure. Yeah.
Like they're like the, when something is that alluring, right? Like you're not like, you probably can't be told that it's impossible. You can't be told no when you're that close to it.
Yeah. Logic.
You know, it's there, you know what it could do. It exists, but it's potentially not recoverable. You're still probably going to try.
Logic and common sense wouldn't stop you. Yeah.
Right.
Especially if you're working with an endless, you know, pool of funding, which it sounds like they probably were. So next we're with Navarro and Rose. Again, Rose is the old lady who saw her dead friend Travis doing an interpretive dance on the ice in episode one. And Rose is explaining to Navarro how she sees Travis sometimes, okay? And apparently Travis had leukemia and he committed suicide by going out onto the ice before the cancer could take him because he didn't want to go out that way.
Mm-hmm.
Rose rolls herself a joint. She talks about Travis saying goodbye to her before he killed himself. He brought her croissants. He sang a little. They fucked a little, which really threw me off because I thought Travis was her son.
Yeah. We were taking a shot in the dark with the son thing.
Yeah.
The way he's lit in the first episode made him look younger.
Yes.
You see now in this episode, like when he is in their coitus bed, that he is the same age as her.
I had to pause it there. I was like, wait a minute. Why is everybody okay with this?
Yeah. By the way, this character is portrayed by Fiona Shaw, who you may recognize most recently from Andor.
Yeah.
Let's just cast her in everything.
Yeah, she's great.
She's great. Like as this in this type of role, small character, you know, kind of like all she just brings like a gravity to things that I feel like every show could probably use. But yeah, she's been really good in limited usage so far.
She'll always be Mrs. Dursley to me.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And she was great in that too, frankly. So it turns out though, with regard to Travis, apparently after he went out to the ice to kill himself, Navarro is the one who found his body, which is just something Navarro does. She's just the one who finds the bodies. And Rose says, that was one last gift from Travis Cole. I got to meet you. Now, this is where the first mention of Cole that we hear in this show. And it's crazy to me because after episode one, there were already people theorizing that there was going to be a connection between this whole scene out here in Alaska and Rust Cole played by Matthew McConaughey in season one of True Detective. Now we have that all but confirmed here with the mention of the last name Cole, and it turns out that basically Travis, the interpretive dancing ghost, is Rust Cole's father. Because in season one of True Detective, Rust also makes reference to like the leukemia as well that his dad had.
I think I just combined a Austin Powers Gold Member.
You did.
With Home Alone.
The father.
The father.
That was the two of them together. Yeah. Yeah. Really special stuff.
Yeah, that is, boy, there is an inside look at my brain right
there.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in there. Okay, so my first question was like, wait, okay, so is Rose Rust's mother? Which, of course, we don't really know. And she kind of describes their relationship as sort of in and out. Like, he only shows up when he wants something,
right,
just
yep,
like he did in life. Kind of like a vagabond, right? But still, a bizarre thing for them to connect between season one and season four. Like, through seasons one through three, you got different... There's always been some kind of creepy spiral going on in every season. But you never got the feeling like, oh, this is all going to be connected somehow. Like, they're gonna find a way to bring this full circle. Now, this season, either they're flirting with that idea or they're full-blown going for it.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell which one yet.
I think they're going to be flirting with it. And I think that the reason that people were theorizing about it already is because I had heard just through, I don't know what, you know, articles, just hear, people just... Stuff that I just heard somehow through the grapevine, sure, was that this season was going to like you're saying, like two and three kind of very offhandedly kind of like acknowledged that maybe that they were in the same kind of universe or they seemed like they were, but that this season would make direct reference to season one. I think there were like some still frames. From early shoots, I think people had some stuff where you could see, like, I won't be surprised if we see Rust Cole's file pulled out at some point,
something like that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I think some of that had maybe like leaked or trickled on to the web 6-8 months ago, even. So that's why I think people were kind of teed up to start making those types of connections. And then early on here, we're getting the spiral. Which is kind of like very referential to all of the season one stuff, and we can continue there. But there are other definite allusions to season one that we'll get to.
Yeah, this had me wondering. Like, I mean, it's kind of a, if you're a huge True Detective fan, if you're a big season one fan, which everybody who's seen the show is. It kind of makes you stop in your tracks. Like, okay, what are they doing here? I started trying to do timelines. I was like, wait, so is the show I'm watching right now taking place a long time ago, or is this more present? Like, it got me all confused and hopped up because I was like sitting there trying to figure, okay, if that was Rust's dad. Mm-hmm. And then, like, just to put it in full perspective of the episode, what are the fucking odds that Rust Cole, this undercover nut, in Louisiana, ends up working a case connected to the Tuttle family and the spiral cult thing. And then it turns out also his dad was in Ennis, Alaska with some lady named Rose puffing joints before he goes out on the ice to kill himself. And that also in Ennis, Alaska, there is a connection to the Tuttle family and the spiral thing. That seems very mathematically improbable and outlandish. Mm. So it really is going to be interesting how they try to pull the... Because if it's just for funsies, if it's just like, ooh, that was Rust's dad, like it's kind of a waste to me. So I think they're going to try to make it actually matter.
Yeah, I think they probably will too.
In like a substantial way. And I'm just really, really curious to see how they try to pull that off because... It just seems so improbable that the Cole family would be in both of these places experiencing this craziness.
Yeah.
Not that his dad necessarily did, but he was there in the setting that craziness goes on anyway. So
they got to get the Reddit boards going, man. You know?
Yeah.
They're doing that. They got to churn the butter, baby.
They've definitely accomplished that through episode two. So moving on, Navarro asks Rose about seeing the dead. And Rose explains that it started with her after Travis died, but that she knows people who are born with it, who are born in Ennis already with this connection to the dead and seeing dead and seeing people that are no longer here and whatnot. And she says that she thinks Ennis is where the fabric of all things is coming apart at the seams, like the world is getting old.
Yeah.
And that's why weird shit happens out there, man.
That was That was a great line. I wondered when I heard that line if like that was one of the first things that Issa Lopez like wrote to like set off this entire idea of Night Country here, because I thought that that was just really cleverly described.
It was almost like a Pizzolatto season one line.
It kind of was. It kind of was. But yeah. I think we rarely stop and think. Nobody ever just like on their day to day stops and really thinks about how the world is, you know, or like the universe is 13 billion years old or whatever, whatever the science people say it is now. And you know, Earth is some number of billion years old. But like, yeah, it's old as shit. Like more than the mind can really comprehend. And so this idea of it just coming apart at the seams here in the Arctic Circle is really like creepy and just well thought through.
Google tells me the Earth is 4.543 billion years old, plus or minus 50 million years.
I was almost going to say, 4 billion is the number that I had in my head for Earth, yeah.
Long time.
Yeah.
Long time. Rose also Navarro is asking about this because she wants to know how to help her sister.
Yeah.
Like, Rose clearly has seen the dead. Her sister is seeing things. She's trying to figure out how to help her sister out. She already brought her sister out to Innes, but it seems like it's getting worse, not better. And Rose tells her not to confuse the spirit world with mental health issues.
Yeah.
Which, I don't really know what the point of that, like, what she's trying to say there. Like, your sister's just sick. She's not connected.
Right.
But I'm not sure how Rose would know that, although Rose just seems like a old witchy woman who knows all kinds of things. So who the hell knows? Because Rose then draws the spirit or the spiral symbol that was on the scientist's head in the snow and also tattooed on Annie Kay in the snow. And Navarro mentions that she's seen it before years ago, which at that point in the episode, we're not sure what she's referencing. Of course, later on, we find out that that was tattooed on Annie Kay's body, and that's where she saw it. Rose tells her that the spiral symbol is very old, older than Innes, older than the ice, probably, which is just good creepy stuff there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Then Danvers goes to the station where this guy, Captain Connolly, has showed up to tell her he's taking the case and moving it to Anchorage. Now, Captain Connolly, you may have noticed from HBO's The Leftovers. Ah. He was the priest in The Leftovers, HBO Family Barrett. But Connolly is also the one who sent Danvers to Innes. He appointed her to this town.
In some type of maybe promotion that wasn't a promotion, sounds
like. Yeah, like he was trying to get rid of her.
Right.
And we get more insight into their relationship that we'll get to later, but Danvers basically refuses to give up the case to Anchorage. She pulls out her little rule book and goes to Section 9, Chapter 4, and reads it to Connolly, and it has something to do with the handling of frozen bodies, and Connolly basically has to concede to Danvers that the case is, for now, remaining with her. So, but he does ask, like, where are you going to put the corpsicle? Danvers goes to an ice hockey rink where her daughter has just finished up a game and her daughter's making eyes with some girl who's going out to skate because her daughter is a player. And I'm assuming that girl is the one from episode 1 who she got in trouble for making the sex tape with.
I think that's a safe assumption.
And Danvers meets the manager of the hockey rink who's named Kate because Danvers wants permission to use the rink to store the corpsicle, and they're going to thaw out the bodies there. And Kate says yes, even though Danvers used to bang her husband, which we find out later as well, and just another person that Danvers has had a sexual relationship with. So the APF, who Danvers works for, drags this block of frozen bodies through town with, like, construction equipment.
I loved the scene with all the people just, like, walking outside and being like,
yeah, and it's hilarious because, like, we talked about this on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles last week, but one of the funny things about this show is going to be that it's just nighttime all of the time, but this was, like, they drove through town in the middle of the day with the corpsicle.
Right.
But it's pitch black because we're in night country. they just put this thing in the middle of the ice rink. I guess no more hockey, skating for a while.
Well, it's only going to take 2 days, 48 hours for the bodies to fall,
right? True enough. But you got to be careful with the soft tissue. Danvers yells that like 3 times in the opening of the episode and then yells it again here when they're like taking the blanket or cover off of the corpsicle.
Well, you got to be careful of the soft tissue.
Well, it just made it feel like they kept making reference to like the handling of the situation and how Danvers isn't equipped and they don't have a forensic specialist and like
no forensic tech. Yeah,
but all you have to do, Barrett, is just yell out, "Careful of the soft tissue," and you're good.
Everybody's very careful of the soft tissue,
and then you're good. Yeah. Navarro shows up at the skating rink and tells Danvers that the spiral they found on the dude's forehead was also on Annie's body, the girl with the missing tongue who was stabbed 30 times, episode one. And Navarro wants to work with Danvers, says it's the same case.
Yep.
Danvers, at this point, says fuck off. Then you got Peter Pryor, the junior detective guy that's like almost like Danvers' apprentice, it seems like.
Yes. Yeah, I would say so.
He uses Face ID on one of these phones to unlock the dude's cell phone.
That's why you need a good young guy. You know, you got to have somebody that just...
They know the tech.
They know the tech.
They know it. It's that Gen Z tech knowledge, man. So he unlocks the dude's phone, and it's the guy that was influencing, the sandwich influencer.
He was making a sandwich TikTok.
And they also found prints on one of the shoes that didn't match any of the bodies. Mm. Danvers theorizes that hypothermia explains a lot of what they're seeing, the delusional behavior, the self-inflicted wounds, the stripping naked, which all checks out.
Mm-hmm.
But then her and Peter Pryor get into like this little coach session.
Yeah.
And she says, start asking questions, which was like, that was one of the it was cool as hell that they had this thing where they're like teaching you basically, here's the kind of mindset you have to have when you're investigating, right?
Yeah.
It's all about the questions you ask.
I liked this. I liked the back and forth between the two of them. I liked her kind of like being master and him student. And you know, like maybe it's a little bit cliche to just be like, what are the right questions?
Yeah.
But I liked the way that they did it because it felt like an approachable way into the mind of like what maybe makes somebody a good detective. Cause like you think about so many procedurals on broadcast television, right? It's usually somebody is some type of like wonderkind, right?
Yeah.
They've got
some
mentalist type. There's literally a show called The Mentalist that I quite liked for some time. But like somebody's got some special gift.
Right.
And like that seems kind of far-fetched for reality. But like just people being able to think through questions and then different kind of variations of those questions. And like, okay, well, asking why somebody would do that is not the right one. But asking, you know, like what's the question before that question? I just liked, I liked how they set this up, and I liked that she was kind of coaching him through the thought process, and it made real world sense to me.
Yes.
And so I appreciated that that line of thinking and thinking through crime scene and investigation in that manner.
Yeah, I think it could come off as a little cliche for sure, but on the other hand, this is definitely the job. You have to, knowing which questions to ask and try to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Is the job of a detective trying to solve a crime, especially one that's as ridiculous and confusing as this one, right?
Yeah, and I don't know if this is... I've never watched any of the Sherlock shows that have been popular over the last few
years. Like the Benedict Cumberbatch one?
Uh-huh, yeah.
I watched that one, solid.
But and then the Robert Downey Jr. movies are like, you know, a decade old, so I don't really remember them very well. But I feel like this is very like Sherlock and Watson-y.
Definitely.
I feel like that's the way that they always kind of solve the crimes, is like thinking about the questions that nobody's thinking to ask.
Yeah, and Sherlock is always the Danvers.
Right, yep.
Elementary Watson, yeah. No, for sure there's like some type of a comparison to be had there. Peter Pryor starts theorizing at the behest of Danvers. First, he comes up with a polar bear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Polar bear came in. The doors are never locked for safety reasons in case there's an accident. Everybody freaks out. They run outside. They keep on pressing. She's like, wrong question. Ask it again. And he says, like, maybe they weren't fully dressed when they ran out because they're asking, like, why would you get outside and then take your shoes off? That kind of thing.
Right.
And then she's like, keeps pressing him. And he says, how scared do you have to be to run out on the ice without any shoes? And why are the clothes folded like that? Maybe the killer folded them. Danvers is like, ah, a killer.
A killer.
Yeah. And then Peter Pryor shows Danvers a video. He's kind of been going, like, as they're talking, he's kind of going through the guy's phone that he unlocked with his dead face. And he shows her a video he found on the scientist's phone, which is the sandwich influencer and his sandwich-making video, where the scientist named Clark, who we know as Raymond Clark by the end of this episode, who is, by the way, wearing that pink parka hoodie.
Yep.
He's got the seizure. He says she's awake. And then, like, this is one of the things about the show that's frustrating, because it's like, oh, look, this is like a real... Like, by the end of this episode, if you're not like, oh, yeah, Raymond Clark had some kind of a meltdown, he's clearly got some serious issues. He probably did this in some regard or is responsible for it, right? But when you're watching the clip they show on the phone, it's almost like a supernatural occurrence happens that shuts the video camera off.
Right, right.
It doesn't just stop recording.
No.
It's like an electrical fucking shock happened or something crazy, which doesn't make sense because he's still a distance from... Anyway, point being, you get some clue of what's going on here, but really you're still asking, like, is there a bigger, crazier, more... spiritual or magic or create like, you know, thing at play.
Yeah, I mean, something happens to him there when he has a little seizure thing.
Yeah.
So
you would think so, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, let's take care of some business and we'll move on to the back half of this thing. Today's episode is brought to you by Factor. And if you're like me, then you're either too busy, too tired, or too ineffective in the kitchen to worry about what's for dinner when you're just trying to relax at the end of the day and binge watch your favorite TV shows. That's where Factor comes in and takes care of everything. I just go to the fridge, pick out a Factor, toss it in the microwave for 2 minutes, and bang, I'm eating like a king on the couch. It's cheaper, better, and better for you than takeout. Get started on your resolutions with Factor so you're ready all 2024. Factor's ready-to-eat meal delivery takes the stress out of meal planning and set you up for success all year long. Skip the grocery stores, prep work, and cooking fatigue. Instead, get chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door with over 35 meals to choose from, including options like keto, calorie smart, vegan plus veggie, and more, plus over 55 weekly add-ons. You'll have a ton of nutritious and flavorful options to kickstart your resolutions. Skip the overpriced takeout trap. Factor is cheaper and way more delicious than takeout. Get chef-crafted, restaurant-quality meals delivered right to your door. They're ready to eat. Heat and eat in just 2 minutes, which means more time for you. Forget frantic lunch preps and rushed dinners as well. Factor's two-minute meals are your secret weapon in the new year. Fuel up fast with restaurant-quality meals, all delivered right to your door. Barrett and I have both thoroughly enjoyed Factor. Solid, solid option. If you don't have time to cook or you're out of groceries or you're just, you know, dealing with the pace of life, Barrett.
Tasty meals, tasty smoothies.
Good
tasty,
stuff.
Tasty wellness shots. They got it all, man.
Mm, breakfast as well. Head to factormeals.com/OCC50 and use code OCC50 to get 50% off. That's code OCC50 at factormeals.com/OCC50 to get 50% off. So Danvers goes and interviews the cleaning ladies, the ladies that clean Salal Station, while Peter is interviewing the supply delivery guy to find out more about these scientists. What were these wacky guys up to out there? The delivery guy tells Peter that Clark, Raymond Clark, particularly, was weird. That he was always weird, but that the last couple of times he went out there to give them their... What do they have? What did they have going on? Lone Star beer and...
Supplies, Funyuns, Lone
Funyuns,
Star.
Funyuns, yeah. You gotta have the Funyuns. The last couple times he went out there, Clark was talking to himself, staring off into space, and then one time he found him just stark naked, just butt-assed in the old research station, and that everybody else, all the other scientists, just ignored Clark when he acted weird, is what the cleaning ladies confirmed, like that he was kind of the most wacky one, but that nobody seemed to pay him any mind when he was having, you know...
Yeah, an episode.
Some kind of weird episodes, the delivery guy also said he thought he saw someone in the station. Of course, that's, you know, we get that scene in episode one that makes it seem like something like runs past real fast. And then he says, like, but you know, this is just Ennis.
That's Ennis, baby.
You just see people sometimes, man. And then he's like, Jesus, Pete, you know this. You grew up here. It's a long fucking night. Even the dead get bored. It's like, okay. That was a little cheesy line there for me that I was a little off put by. But he also says that, you know, when he saw Clark naked, he had the spiral tattoo on his chest.
Yes. Yeah, that's really honestly the big reveal, right? That's the big clue that leads them to a major discovery. I thought that the not necessarily cheesy, but I just thought it was funny that they borrowed the old Law and Order, like when you're interviewing a subject, they have to continue doing whatever it is that they are doing.
Yeah, you're just along for the ride.
You are just along for the ride, and they are walking and talking. They're unpacking shit. They are doing their job.
Filling up the vending machine.
They're at the docks. They're unpacking the fish. They're loading the truck. They're filling the vending machine. They're walking. You're in the truck.
He rides with him
in the truck because this guy cannot stop to slow down and have a chat in the middle of his workday.
That was hilarious.
For 5 minutes. And like this, you know,
the cleaning lady.
The cleaning lady, the housekeeper, she's getting off work. She's not going to stop. She's got to get off work, man. She's got to go to her locker. She's got to get home. There's no time to stop to chat.
I know. I love the one clean, like the first cleaning lady she's talking to who's clocking out.
Uh-huh.
She's like on her way out the door. So she just passes the little spiral symbol to like another cleaning lady. Yeah. Like, you ever seen this devil mark before? And then she's off. Yeah, that was great.
But so that was funny. And like, I get it. Like the motion, like it's nice to have the motion in there. It keeps the episode going a little bit, but it's just so funny because it's like a long time Law and Order trope at this point that they just kind of threw in there. But yeah. So, yes, tattoo on Clark's chest.
Yeah. And Navarro then almost, like, she's, like, driving along and, like, a Spice Girls song comes on. And she's like, oh, I'm going to leave a voicemail for my sister because this is totally our jam. We love this Spice Girls song. But then she drops the phone because she's not paying attention to the road. And the whole time you're watching, you're like, oh, she's going to crash the car.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She's driving like a fucking idiot. What is she doing here? It gave me anxiety. Drops the phone, reaches down to find the phone, but pulls up this necklace and then has like a flashback to what I assume is her as a child and her mother, because there's been talk about her mother and how her mother had delusions in mental health episodes, her mother having a freaking meltdown with this necklace on.
Okay, good. Yeah, I didn't catch it. I thought it was her sister. I thought it was a flashback to her sister.
No, because I think she's curled up with her sister.
That makes sense. That makes more sense.
So she's like, fuck my mom, and like throws the necklace out the window, but they show the necklace hit the ground. Anyway, that just felt like a moment we were supposed to keep track of. So Navarro goes and interviews this mining dude from the bar earlier, who it turns out his cousin. This was tough to track in real time watching the episode one time through. I was like, wait, who's this fucking guy that she's now talking to? But he says that his cousin sold the scientist Clark Eagle trailer.
She goes to Kravitz.
Yeah.
It's like, but like with a QR or something like that.
Yeah.
She's at the bar. She's talking to Annie K's brother again.
Right.
With the Frank Clark. Is it Frank Clark? No, Clark Reynolds Clark? Raymond Clark. Raymond Clark. Frank Clark is a NFL defensive lineman, I think. and then that guy comes up and
there's like a fight, right?
She can tell that like he sees the photo and like
recognizes
the guy.
You're right.
But then says he doesn't.
Right.
The difficult part for me to understand was where she goes to question him. I decided it was like a dorm style apartment for like, I think he's a minor.
For the minors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it was a very strange setup. At first I was like, is this a rehab facility or some kind of a hospital situation?
Yeah.
Or what the fuck? Because it's like very much a college dormitory setup.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like a dorm for the minors.
Signage on the door.
Minors. Yeah. Yeah.
And stuff. But yeah, so he says his cousin sold Clark a Golden Eagle trailer for $10,000 cash roughly 7 years ago or so. And then we're with Hank Pryor, who is clearly getting scammed by his mail order bride situation.
Yes.
She's like, yes, but I'm just worried about mother. And that voice message he sends her, man, that was the most simp behavior you can possibly imagine.
John Hawks finally came through doing John Hawks shit in this episode.
Yes.
Which is being an absolute ass.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, yeah, because this dude is, you are not supposed to like John Hawks in anything he's ever in, basically.
Right.
You know,
well,
what he's good at. And in this episode, you're like, okay, yeah, we don't like this guy.
Yeah, fuck this guy. Takes big steps in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
She asks him, the mail order bride does, to send more photos of himself. And I thought he was about to go, like, take some dick pics.
Dick pic? Yeah, yeah.
But no, he's going, this is the most boomer shit you've ever seen. He's going around the house finding photos of himself framed, snapping photos of the photos, and then sending them on.
Did you think that was also kind of like he's kind of like a little bit catfishing her, sending younger photos of himself?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, and that's what people do typically on, you know, especially through, like, with all the dating apps and stuff these days. People tend to misrepresent themselves in some way, shape, or form.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Mm. I've never used them, but that's what I've heard, Barrett. Also, made me wonder, like, if this whole catfishing bride thing they've referenced is going to come back and be connected in some other way. Because it does seem like a strange character trope to just, like, bring up twice in two episodes. It's just a little weird. Like, once in episode one, you're like, okay, yeah, maybe he's a little bit of a doofus, something weird going on there with some international woman that he's bringing into town to fucking Ennis, Alaska. And you asked in episode one, how do you end up in Ennis, Alaska?
Right?
Like, what woman would move out there for this fucking guy? And then it, you know, becomes very blatant in this episode that he is indeed being scammed and he's like sending her money and shit.
Yeah.
But it makes me wonder if that's going to come into play on a bigger scale. But as he's going around the house taking pictures of himself, he realizes that his son, Peter, came in and stole that file.
Yeah.
Question, what the fuck file is that? Because
it's the Annie K file.
The Annie K file, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a point later in the episode where Danvers is going through Clark's stuff and sees all his crazy notes and ravings and wild drawings and shit. And I thought that looked like it came out of the Annie K file.
No, I don't think so. I think that's stuff pulled from Salal.
Okay, separately. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
That clears that up. So Peter Pryor tells Danvers that we finally get the answer here. The rest of the funding for Salal comes from a shell company called NC Global Strategies, which belongs to Tuttle United. And this is the second direct reference to season one, because the Tuttle family is the head of the cult in season one. And again, same question as earlier when they bring up Cole. How the fuck they're going to make all this connect or really matter or make sense on that level of global scale, because that's crazy. Between Alaska and Louisiana is a lot of miles. I'm just curious how they're going to make that all work out. But yeah, so it just brings into question exactly what the hell is happening at Salal. If the science teacher earlier says that they're working on something that can't actually be done, right? And I agree with what Barrett is saying. It's like, if you have this, a discovery that's going to change mankind, even if it seems impossible, you keep cracking away at that.
Yep.
But then also there's strange, the money coming in that's keeping Salal funded and running is weird and suspicious.
Yes, very obviously very suspicious. It's from, anytime a multifaceted global internet, the words are all slipping in my mind. A massive conglomerate, is like operating a shell company, and that shell company is funding the NGO or whatever, and they make all sorts of products that could potentially benefit and profit from
bunch of weird
research
stuff
going on here. You got the makings of a conspiracy, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, very strange. Danvers then finds that what she's like going through her place to get out Christmas decorations. It's Christmas time in Ennis, and she finds that one-eyed polar bear stuffed animal again. And she has like a flashback to where she's playing with her son, and I assume it was her son, and that bear, and he like covers his eye and says something like, "I'm the one eye." And then later in the episode, we see a flashback.
And Twist and Shout's playing. Did you say that?
Was it?
Yeah.
No shit.
Yeah, in that flashback.
Oh.
Yeah, there's like a little boombox above them, and it's playing Twist and Shout.
Oh, shit. Okay. And then we see her dancing with her husband in a flashback later in the episode as well, and I assume both of them are dead.
You gotta think so.
Yeah. So then she goes and bangs Captain Connolly, because it turns out they've been banging for 19 years.
Yeah. Also, note we skipped over the fact that she also banged the husband of the ice skate rink manager.
I mentioned it.
Oh, you did. Say
yeah,
that.
Just in passing, quickly. Okay. Yeah. She's the town bicycle. Everybody's had a ride.
Yeah. So look, we're getting more information is coming out about Danvers with the way that she's kind of potentially chewed up and spit out men, the fact that she like got this promotion that was sort of a demotion, the way that she treats a Navarro and even Pryor, who she's like a great potentially too tough a boss on, and like by all account what I felt we got more of in this episode. And I believe this is something that Issa Lopez has talked about, is that Danvers is a female antihero. She's not a good person.
Right.
But we're rooting for her cause because we kind of like her anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's definitely, I definitely felt them putting her more into this frame of like, this person kind of sucks.
For sure.
You know, she's not happy, and she takes it out on, you know, and she's experienced trauma, and she takes that out in on a bunch of different people in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah.
But that if it helps anybody that's like, "Oh, Danvers sucks." Well, they're just giving her the anti-hero treatment, which we love when they do with guys. So I just want to put a cap on if you feel yourself bucking against Danvers,
you're supposed to
just like rethink that little bit, because you're
supposed to on some level.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's like with Martin Hart in season one, Hart, the opposite of Cole.
He's
a piece of shit. He's a terrible fucking guy. He's cheating on his wife the whole time with young college girls and big titties, and he's, you know what I mean? He's carrying on an affair to the point that at some point he's at a Western bar with his wife. The college student that he's been having an affair with is there, and he goes and like meets her at the bar and has a conversation with her. His wife is like 20 feet away. So like, yeah, I'm completely on board with you. And it's one of those things like you just kind of have to, you have to, especially early on in the season like this, you've got to be on board for the ride.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But yes, if you find yourself rooting for her, but also despising her, that's kind of where you're supposed to be at.
Yeah.
So again, her and Captain Connolly have this long relationship, 19 years spanning multiple marriages for each of them, it sounds like, or I mean, between the two of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they say this is the last time they do this, and they say that every time, and it's a running joke between them. And Connolly doesn't want Danvers to keep this case, wants to take it to Anchorage. Liz says she can keep control of it, though, and she ends up like storming out, calling him a fucker.
Yeah, he kind of threatens her.
And you can't really get a feel for if, like, is Captain Connolly doing some kind of a cover-up here? He doesn't want her, like, digging in and actually solving it, or is he just this dude that she's having an affair with? We don't really know yet. There's not really a reason for us to think Connolly's a piece of shit. Just that they have a very complicated relationship between the two of them,
yeah,
to the point that he ended up shipping her out to Ennis.
Yep.
Right? So Hank Pryor, who earlier figured out his son Peter had stolen those files, goes and slaps the shit out of him at the old ice skating rink and tells him, Danvers doesn't own you, you have a family, and she's not in it. Blood is blood, Peter. Remember that. Which really pushes you in the direction of like, oh, Hank Pryor is going to end up being a bad guy here. Less of an anti-hero thing and more of just like a straight
yeah,
up,
just a bad
oh
dude.
Shit, he might be bad.
Yeah, Danvers asked him for the file and he was like, no, I don't, in the first episode, and he's like, no, I don't have
not
that
one.
Not
even sure I have
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I don't even have it. I don't know, I'll look for it, but I won't. Yeah, that's, so he is likely not part of the conspiracy or the cover up, but again, this kind of running theme that we got when Navarro is talking to the guy that knew Clark, like a lot of people in this town were okay with what happened to Annie. You
right.
know, thought she kind of deserved it or were at the, you know, at best just like okay with it.
She asked basically. For it.
She asked yeah. for it. Yep.
She was protesting yep. this thing she shouldn't have been protesting, messing with the wrong people.
And that's and also as we know, Hank was, I believe, the chief or the leader of this police force
at that time.
And so this is this is like negligence and pretty shitty on his part is what we're
right.
seeing.
Almost like obstruction.
That he wanted yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That he wanted to conceal this file basically and keep it out of the hands of Danvers.
Yeah. yeah. Then Danvers gets the scientist Clark's credit card records and sees he got the spiral tattoo in April of 2017. So when they dropped that date, I was like, okay, this is I'm looking at now.
Mm-hmm.
Like what we're watching unfold in True Detective Night Country is present day 2023, 2024 in my mind,
yep.
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So 2017, he got this tattoo for $600. This was another scene where I was like, okay, I'm not sure if I buy this because she calls the tattoo artist, who somehow remembers this exact fucking guy. This is like 6 years ago he got this
mm-hmm,
tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
He was Irish. He cried a little when she finished, but not like he was sad, like it was sentimental. He was alone. He didn't tell her what the tattoo meant. And then she's like, I've got some photos of him. And not only do I have photos of him from when I did the tattoo, I've got the model photo he brought in to show me to be like, this is what I want.
Yeah, yeah.
So she sends those to Danvers. And, of course, the model for the work was Annie Kay.
Yeah.
And they had a secret relationship. And that kicks off the whole...
All a little too convenient for you, huh, Ross?
Little bit, I'd say.
Well, you've clearly never gotten a tattoo and don't know many tattoo artists because this is quite normal.
They remember every single person that they're...
These are the canvases for the art.
That's
you know
true.
What I mean?
That's true. You have to take it seriously.
And they document it. They write it down.
Think about it.
Yeah, this one especially, I think, just had like a photographic memory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there was no jumps in logic here.
Yeah, yeah, just a straight line.
Just a straight line.
Yeah,
yeah.
So Danvers goes to Navarro, tells her all this.
That's why I pay cash for all my tattoos.
I see. Yeah, there's no paper trail, dude. Shows her the photos, and basically asks her, in so many words, to work the case with her. But this is the last time, Barrett. They're going to work together. They're going to close these cases, but then they're going to go their separate ways.
That's it for us, Ross.
That's it.
That's it for us.
That's it. Then Navarro goes and visits Kavik. Kavik?
Kavik.
It's Q-A-V-V-I-K.
Kavik. Kavik. Yeah.
Which is the dude she power fucked in episode one. And what does he own?
He owns like, the bar. He owns the bar.
But he's also a veterinarian in the back with wolves? earlier in the, we skipped that scene because there wasn't like a bunch of shit there,
but
shows up and he's like working on a wolf.
That's right.
And she's like, these dogs are going to eat you one day. And he's like, this is old Bessie, my sweet friend. Anyway, I'm just curious what the fuck is going on with Kavik at this point.
Okay, yeah. Well, I also don't know. Okay, so he's got, they've done a good job of like some location stuff in Ennis. Like, you can kind of get a feel for the how small the town is.
Yeah.
But Kavik's place of residence / bar / the kitchen.
What is that?
Where is he when he's making up when he's doing the flapjacks? Because I think it's the same area that he was treating the dog.
I think so.
But is that at his place? Is his place above the bar? Like, what is the?
I think it's one of those situations. But he definitely. I mean, my impression was that he lives where he works.
Yeah. Okay. That's the general sense that I'm getting.
And the bar's got a kitchen.
And the bar,
little kitchen back there.
Yeah.
But also,
I thought the dog was his dog.
I think he took it and off the ice. Like it hurt its foot or something. Anyway, Kavik is an interesting character.
I thought that was like a Malamute.
I think it was a wolf.
You think it was a full on? It was a
full blown wolf that he brought in and was fucking nursing back to health.
Okay, all right.
But Navarro visits him, and unfortunately, he has just masturbated, so they cannot. He's not ready for sex, but he does cook them up some food. And they kind of get into, like, basically Navarro is at a loss at this point. She's kind of like, I don't know where I'm supposed to go next. But their conversation sparks the right question for her, which was kind of the theme of this episode, right? And the right question for her here is, how? How do you conceal a secret relationship that you're having? And that's why he got the trailer, she says, to keep it a secret. And where do you keep a trailer to fucking secret? The Nook. Mm. Some area of town where clearly...
Lover's Lane.
Yeah, exactly. This is Ennis's Lover's Lane. And Navarro goes out to the Nook. She finds Raymond Clark's trailer that he bought, 7 years ago for $10,000 from that one miner's cousin.
Yeah.
And it's full Carcosa style.
It is.
Covered
it
in
is,
crazy
it is
drawings.
Straight up Carcosa in this bitch.
Weird stick dolls and twine and string and shit hanging
There's
all over the place.
Dolls. There's I thought it was a body on the bed.
I thought it was a body the whole time. Like when the episode finished, I was like, wait, so was that.
What about that body?
Was that Annie Kay's body? And my wife was like, it's a doll, dimwit.
Yeah, apparently the wives got this because I did the exact same thing. And she was like, no, it was just like a voodoo doll.
Voodoo doll, exactly. Because I thought he had like somehow gotten Annie Kay's body and then wrapped string around it and put it
mummified her type of shit.
But I think when you say voodoo, I think you're on the right track. It almost seemed like he's trying to reanimate her somehow or like bring her back to life or something with this, because there's pictures of her everywhere. He's got crazy writing scrawled all over the fucking trailer.
Yeah.
The spiral symbol is on the ceiling. And I would say it's drawn on the ceiling, except that it seems like it was burned into the ceiling with a fucking blowtorch. It couldn't be creepier. Like this guy completely exited reality and is living in crazy town in this fucking trailer. Mm-hmm. And God knows what he was doing with that.
Got all sorts of animal bones on the table.
Yeah. Weird Arctic animals.
Seal
too.
Bones.
Caribou. Yeah. Yeah.
Which
I don't know.
The same thing as a reindeer.
Yeah. What the fuck he was doing in there, we do not know yet, but it was truly, truly creepy. And like, if you, again, you don't have to have seen any other seasons of this show for this season to make sense, but if you're needing a little connection, in season one, there is a repeated reference to this place called Carcosa, where the season kind of ends, climaxes, if you will, and it looks like the inside of that trailer, suffice it to say. Annie Kay's phone is also in the trailer, which was not on her body when Navarro found her. Mm-hmm. And the screen is cracked. That seems like a big deal. Like her phone would be something they can use, right?
Yeah, and also, so we're obviously picking up more and more Annie Kay clues. And I don't know if you mentioned this, but among many kind of like sparks, right? Like one of the reasons that the Danvers shows up at Navarro's is because they confirmed that the tongue was Annie Kay's.
Yes.
So that's confirmed. So Navarro has been right this whole time. That was her tongue. These cases are connected in some way, shape, or form. Yeah.
Now, my guess would be that Clark, for whatever reason, was carrying her tongue around.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
If you read any of the like scribblings he had in that journal or the stuff on the walls, which you would basically have to pause the show to do, it seemed like he was obsessing over her and the loss of her.
Yes.
And then
he got the tattoo 4 days after she died.
And it's her tattoo.
It's her tattoo. You know? And that's why he's sentimental crying about it, right?
Right. Yep. So, yep. like, it does track that he would have the tongue for one reason or another. But I think you're also asking the question, like, did he kill her?
Right.
At this
totally.
Point, you know?
100%. Yep.
Or
yep.
where the
yeah,
fuck would he have gotten the tongue?
Yeah.
Right.
I guess it's possible that somebody did bring the tongue back, you know, to Salal that to kick off this scene of madness.
Yeah.
But it also feels very likely that Clark had the tongue in his possession.
Yeah, because he was a bit obsessive and clearly not all there upstairs. He was having some issues. This Danvers goes through Clark's notebooks. He's drawn and scribbled crazy shit all over the place, right? And then Navarro calls her out to the trailer, and that's where she shows her all this shit, the giant doll person on the bed, voodoo situation, it seems like, and the giant spiral on the ceiling and all that. Then, as they're out there looking through the trailer, Danvers gets a call from Peter, who tells her, Chief, we have a problem. And they give us a shot of the outside of the trailer, too, where there's like an upside-down dead raven, like, nailed into the side of the wall and all kinds of creepy shit. And so Danvers and Navarro go to the ice hockey rink where Peter tells her the bodies have started thawing and there are only six. We are missing the seventh. They're missing Raymond Clark specifically. He is not in the corpsicle. He's not there. He's alive. He's out there, Barrett. Cue Seven Devils by Florence and the Machine, which was a good song choice.
Yeah,
that was good
song,
stuff,
yeah,
you know, because there's supposed to be seven.
Seven of them. And there's some devil stuff going on, too.
But there's only six. Yeah, exactly. So an exciting episode. This was a fun one.
I thought so, too. I thought this was a better episode. I thought they were able to narrow it a little bit, focus it up, get to more of the case work and the creepy stuff and all of that. So
yeah, my question was always, how are we going to, with what they gave us in episode one, I was like, how are we going to get through this in six episodes?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I didn't think we'd have a moment like we do in episode two until like three or four.
Right. Right.
So to get there already in episode two is huge. Kind of shows you the pacing of this is going to.
Yep, I agree.
We're going to move quickly.
That. Yep.
And there's been both online and in like our friend text group a little speculation about like why are we bringing in all these like why bring in Danvers' daughter as a character? Why bring in Navarro's sister as a character? Why are we dealing with so many people? It seems like they introduced too many and they needed to narrow the scope. Based on what we've seen through two episodes, I think this show and the reason for all the positive reviews that we've seen is going to be that they tie all of this together by episode six. I think Navarro's sister and Danvers' daughter will both have some kind of a part to play. I think all of that shit is going to come in and get looped in somehow. So I got the feeling in this episode that something really bad was going to happen to Danvers' daughter.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Mm. It just like that. There was some kind of an ominous feel to some of her scenes, and what's going on with her and this girl that she's not supposed to be having a relationship with, that she's continuing to have a relationship with, it seemed like that was going to somehow explode and come into play. All things considered, if you weren't super into episode one, I think this one probably turned it up a little bit for you, because now we do have some full blown creepy shit, some serious direction in terms of this guy Raymond Clark both being very, very clearly tied to Annie Kay, and then also disappearing from the city. Like, they thought they were going to find his thawed out body in the corpsicle.
Yeah, they thought it was just somewhere buried in there, in the middle. Yeah.
But it's not. And Navarro seems very, very sure, you know, based on her detective insight, sixth sense, and potentially messaging from her spirit animal, that this guy is still out there somewhere and that he's alive out there somewhere. And crazy stuff.
I would also add that between Danvers' daughter and Navarro's sister and Annie Kay, these are all people that are these are Native women, Native women, and so I think that seems to be the through line for at least those three side characters. And I think that even in this episode, right, like there was another piece that was kind of vague and you couldn't really latch onto it, but the bar fight starts.
Yeah,
because like the water the town's water is getting screwed up by the mines, and like there's some very obvious conflict going on between like the white folks and the native folks.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and that seems to play into like why Annie Kay was killed, why nobody cared about it, and so it's like I think even if it's even if the only thing it's doing is talking about how like the troubles of and kind of the trials and tribulations that these particular young women are going through without the same kind of care, attention, access, etc. Like, it could be as simple as that, but I think you're right. I think it probably comes together in a bigger, more significant way. But that seems like the obvious place for me that it could that it's at least a touch point. It's a connection point between like these three young women.
Yeah, they got the face tattoos and stuff. Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
I was trying to look up what they're called, but it's not.
It's not a word I would.
It's not readily available, I'm not going to attempt it and botch it.
They dropped it in with the grandma.
Yeah.
In this episode. But no, I'm with you. I mean, I think there's like the obvious. I don't want to say obvious, but like the side of the story that we're getting a lot of clarity on, which you just highlighted, and then there's the side that's like, all right, but what the hell with Raymond Clark? Why was this dude completely batshit crazy? Was it just the isolation out there?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like he was the only one that had really lost his marbles at the ice station, like at the research station. Like, everybody else was kind of ignoring him because they didn't want to deal with like his craziness.
Yep.
And he's got this trailer and he had this affair. And did he kill Annie, or was he so distraught when she was killed that he had a total meltdown and has like slipped into insanity, or what the fuck? And then again, we go back to the original problem here, which is, even if he killed Annie Kay or he knows who did or whatever, Annie Kay aside, what the hell happened to all these scientists?
Right,
why are they butt-ass naked out in the middle of the freezing weather, turning into an ice block, which apparently one of them somehow survived? there's a lot to chew on here that you have to assume all gets tied up and connected somehow. So really stoked for episode 3. I thought this one picked up good momentum and had me in a good place where I was excited to watch again. So,
In the quick Googling there, when I was looking for the name of the indigenous folks in Ennis, it looks like, man, there's a shitload of Reddit theorizing going around.
Yeah, that's what people do with True Detective, man. Yeah. They love that.
I just saw a picture, I think, from a character from season 1 that has a bunch of black stars going down her neck.
Okay.
And Annie Kay was killed with something that was leaving black star-shaped marks. I don't know. People are having fun with it. That's as they do with the True Detective mysteries.
It's the true crime stuff, man. People eat it up. They love it. I mean, we questioned it last week at some point. It may have been on Patreon. I can't remember. Like, you taught us or told us that the showrunner, the writer, what's her name?
Issa Lopez.
That she actually was working on this story before it got looped in and
that's
branded
right.
True Detective?
Yeah, she was True Night Country. You know, I don't know how far she was on it, but the concept, the idea for this story, you know, where she, I think what she said is like, she had the place, she had Arctic Circle, she kind of had the two detectives going. She was writing it with Jodie Foster in mind. And then HBO called and was like, you know, like, hey, what do you got? I think just talking through ideas. And they said, what would you do with True Detective, basically?
Right.
And they were kind of able to marry the two things as she continued to develop it and write it.
And I thought some more about that in the why. I'm trying to ask the right questions here, Barry.
Sure.
And I think it makes really good sense, because if you look at stuff like Mayor of Easttown, and there were a couple other examples that HBO has had come out in the last 5 years, I think shows, in particular of late, have struggled to get a big audience, big viewership, unless there's some pre-existing thing, right?
Yeah,
like, this is why Hollywood does all the pre-existing IP, right? Because it's harder to get somebody to buy into a new show called Night Country than it is to buy into a new show called True Detective Night Country, because, of course, as 100%. You said last week, True Detective had one of the greatest seasons in the history of TV as their opening season. So it really makes sense from that perspective. I was struggling with this over the weekend. I was just kind of like, I don't know, man. If I was writing something badass and then HBO was like, how about we brand it True Detective? I'd be like, fuck you.
Yeah.
I get it, because if you want to tell good stories these days, you got to get people to watch or that, guess what? They cancel your show and you don't get to finish your story.
That's exactly right. So if you're a creator, like you said, and like, this is the chance to get this thing that you love and have been working on, like, you take it.
Yeah, absolutely.
What it makes me think of is like, how much of the kind of the Cole connection, of the Spiral connection, of the Carcoso, like how much of that was kind of like forced into the show by HBO versus how much was the creator able to take her idea and kind of work it in pretty naturally, right? We're obviously going to get there. And so it's kind of, for right now, it's kind of bittersweet, kind of gifty and cursy, is the way that I'll describe it right now, because I love that we're getting the connections. I like that there's theorizing happening. It makes the conversation around the show more fun.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, you know, we know because it's happening within our own group chats and in the online conversation. But like, you brand this thing True Detective and immediately it gets compared to season one.
Right.
And that's just that's
the downside.
It's not fair. It's not fair, really, because like, if the show had just come out as a new detective show on HBO called Night Country, we would just be taking it at face value, judging it against itself and on the qualities and enjoyment of our own show, rather than being like, yeah, but you know what season one did really well?
Yeah.
Right? Like, because, and that's just, it's, that's always, you know, I don't know how many times you can say it, but like, season one of True Detective is one of probably like the top five best seasons of television, like of the last, I don't know, 20 years, I'd say.
I'd say probably ever.
Like it's just a phenomenal season of television that essentially it a lot of like Mayor of Easttown, Big Little Lies, like the massive movie stars coming and playing around in the television sandbox. Like True Detective is what kicked that off.
Yes, dude. 100%. That was one of the things that made it so intriguing going in. You're like, "Oh, McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, this is some wild shit. What the fuck?" Because I don't think that many of us would have tuned in for just this random HBO true crime type of thing unless they had been there.
And then another thing that we were talking about off mic is just like how they caught lightning in a bottle with this, like, it was a partnership. Like, Cary Fukunaga, the director, and the director of most of the episodes of season one, or at least half of them, and Nick Pizzolatto were like a team. They were pitching True Detective around town as a team.
Right.
And then there was like all this tension between the two because Nick Pizzolatto is like this insane, like very wordy writer, and Cary is this visionary director, right? And so it's like they're kind of like their battle, the push and pull between them
is what made the magic.
Anyway, so
and then
just,
not Nick Pizzolatto, the other guy named
Cary Fukunaga.
Fukunaga exited the show.
Yep, he did not come back after season one.
And then season two was what it was.
Right.
And in fairness, if you're going to compare season four to anything, the brighter side would be to compare it to season two.
Yeah.
Because it's so much better than that through two episodes. I'll tell you that.
Yes. Yeah, so it's just, like I said, it's kind of gift and curse because it's fun that we get the connections and the theorizing and all that type of stuff, but it's also, it's not super fair to the show to be comparing it to True Detective season one.
Yeah. And I mean, I assume if you're Issa Lopez, you had to weigh those things against each other going in, you know this, and then kind of decide, well, fuck it. It's worth it. Barrett and I will obviously be talking even further about episode two, part two, rather, of True Detective Night Country later this week on patreon.com/oysters, clams, cockles, where every week during the 6-week run, we will be taking hotline calls from what is known as the Mollusk Militia on Patreon, and they will help us further discuss and digest what we have seen so far through two parts of True Detective Night Country. Go to Patreon, patreon.com/oysters, clams, cockles, to subscribe. For as little as $5, you gain access to our entire backlog of all our Patreon content, which is all ad-free premium episodes that are not available anywhere else, including Barrett and I's entire companion podcast for The Sopranos, which is friendly to first-timers and rewatchers, all of our House of the Dragon bonus coverage, The White Lotus, The Last of Us, Succession's final season, every show that we've covered really in the last few years. Has some version of Patreon content, as well as like 17 different movies that we've done on Patreon. So go to patreon.com/oysters, clams, cockles today, gain access to that entire backlog of content, and then also you will get this week's bonus episode covering even more of part two of True Detective Night Country. We'd also appreciate it if you would support our sponsors by using our dedicated URLs and codes. It's the other way we pay the bills here at Oysters, Clams, and Cockles. You can see the sponsor for today's show in the description of the episode below. Today we had factormeals.com/OCC50. Use code OCC50 to get 50% off. For more from me, Ross Bolin, listen to the Ross Bolin podcast wherever podcasts are played. For more from Mr. Barrett Dudley, follow him on the gram at Barrett Dudley.
Si, senor.
That's the way to do it. B-A-R-R-E-T-T Dudley on Instagram. I'm at W.R. Bolin on Instagram and Twitter. Go to bolinmedia.com/shop to grab yourself some merch. Thanks for being here today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. And until we meet again, remember, time is a flat circle.